The following is a recording of Professor Solomon Kahn presenting Haunted by Chaos, China's Grand Strategy from Mao Zedong to Xi Jinping on November 15, 2019.
I want to thank you all for coming out in the rain. I know that it might have interfered with some tea times or court times, but we're glad you're here, and I think you'll be glad you're here after we hear what our speaker has to say, and after you have a chance to ask some questions. Before we begin, I do want to call your attention to a couple of things. We have guests today from Hilton Head Prep. They're sitting up here. And Stephen Moe is their coordinator. And I guess that they have a question or two. They're going to be competing in the Model UN program, which we help organize, coordinate, and sponsor some things for. So we're glad to have them today. I want to mention two other things. The evening speaker series lineup is complete. I think I mentioned that a couple weeks ago. And it's probably about time to start signing up. As a reminder, the first speaker is going to be Bing West, who is a part-time Hilton Head Island resident and co-wrote Jim Mattis's recently published book on his career, leading to his being a four-star and Secretary of Defense. Also, I want to call your attention to another book. This is called The New Rules of War by Sean McFate, who's going to be our speaker here after the first of the year. It's a good read. It's got a lot of thought-provoking information to it, and my guess is there'll be a lot of questions on that. Okay, at this point, I'd like to introduce Admiral Bill Pendley, who is on our program committee and reached out and contacted today's speaker. He'll do a brief introduction.
Good morning. It's a real pleasure to have the privilege of introducing our speaker today. Professor Kahn is a historian. He deals in primary sources and in-depth research. And he's written in many periodicals, including The Economist, and professional publications such as Foreign Affairs. He earned his PhD at Yale University, and he is currently the Denison Chair of History and Diplomacy at the Fletcher School in Tufts University. He teaches a course there on China and international relations. His most recent book, Haunted by Chaos, which you have an opportunity to buy if you'd like and get signed, is a comprehensive analysis of Chinese grand strategy from Mao to the current leadership in China. What a journey that is, if you can imagine, from the Civil War in China through 1949 and the end of the century of humiliation, up to China as a major power today in 2019. It's a really fascinating read. And he points out that along with China's rise has also been a rise in its insecurity. So we're fortunate to have him, given basically the fact that the focus is on China in many ways and the U.S. state of U.S.-China relations against a backdrop of the reality that whether Chinese motivations and strategies succeed or fail, they may well define this century in which we're living. So I'd like you to ignore the weather and join me in giving a very warm welcome to Dr. Kahn.
First of all, thank you very much for having me. I should say this has already been an education. I found Bill's name on a bunch of declassified documents about he was writing a memo to the Undersecretary of Defense about inspections of North Korean facilities and how the ROK might have a different idea about them. And then John this morning put me through my bases on what exactly inspection looked like. So I've already learned more from this than you're going to learn in anything I have to say. So thank you for that. Usually when I talk about China, I do a deep dive into Chinese grand strategy, which encompasses a lot more than U.S.-China relations. But given where we are today, given the concerns about China and the headlines, the trade relationship, what does China want in the South China Sea, what should American policy look like, given that this is the run-up time now to an election where we should be talking about our China policy, I thought what I'd like to do instead would be to go through the U.S.-China relationship. And we'll talk about Chinese grand strategy on the way and how that's different from the U.S.-China relationship. But just to see how this country has approached China over the past, how that has collided with what China actually is at various points, where the blind spots on each side are, might be helpful as we try to figure out what we want to do in the years to come. So that's what I'm going to aim to do today, and I hope you will take up anything and everything I have to say in Q&A. The best point to start the story, perhaps, is with the discovery of the China market by the United States way back when, which is in many ways a British inheritance. People tend to forget that one of the concerns when the United States waged the War of Independence was what's going to happen to the trade relationship. And John Jay, of course, when negotiating with the Treaty of Paris, was very distinct on that having to be preserved. But that means that the idea of China as a market, China as a place where people could go make money, China as a place where ships would carry stuff and bring stuff back, was something that was woven into this country's DNA from the beginning. It was an American concern way back when. And when the Opium Wars break out in the 1840s, the United States is actually in on the action. The Treaty of Huangxia, which is one of the treaties the Chinese dub an unequal treaty, going back to the century of humiliation when, as the narrative in China has it, Western powers came in, carved China up, imposed unequal treaties on it, and made the Chinese look weak and made a lot of money in the process. Now, there's problems with that narrative, but that's the way it's remembered in China. The United States was in on that action, and the Treaty of Huangxia was part of it. The open door policy, which John Hay proclaimed and which Vice President Mike Pence mentioned in his famous speech at the Hudson Institute, the way we remember it is Western powers were carving China up. The United States went in, said you're going to respect the territorial integrity of China and maintain Chinese sovereignty. That's not what happened. The open door policy, when it said maintain the territorial integrity of China, actually meant that the different powers that had carved China up would not try to exclude other great powers from the action. In other words, Chinese sovereignty was already compromised, and we were going to cooperate to keep on compromising it. So when you read a speech or hear of a speech that says, we kept Chinese sovereignty going, that isn't true, and the Chinese know it. The Washington system, the treaties that followed in the 1920s that aimed to maintain a naval balance of power in the Pacific, mentioned the territorial integrity of China, but with the same goal in mind. China should be open for business to everyone. So it's not going to become someone's colony. It's going to be a colony for everybody. So that century of humiliation narrative, which the United States wrote itself out of, is one in which we were deeply implicated and involved, and the Chinese remember that. What begins to change all this, but change this in ways that we still haven't grappled with fully, I would argue, is the emergence of World War II. I usually have a hard time explaining this to people who don't do China studies. We tend to think of World War II as starting in Europe, even now. It's Hitler, it's the Nazis, it's the invasion of Poland, it's appeasement. If you're living in China, it probably starts off much earlier. Remember, there was a Pacific component to the war, too. You can pick as your starting point 1931, when the Japanese create the puppet kingdom of Manchukuo. You can pick 1937, when the Sino-Japanese War breaks out in earnest. Or you can pick 1941, when the United States becomes involved in this war. Any one of those is a good starting point for saying this is where World War II really starts. But what's interesting during this from a U.S.-China relations perspective is that there's a lot of support for China again in the United States. And the idea of China being independent, China being one of the five policemen of the world, which it would later become in the Security Council, is one that takes off in this era. At the same time, there's a lot of confusion because nobody has an answer to a really simple question. What is China? It sounds kind of academic, but if you think about it, who do you call when you call China, to borrow from Henry Kissinger, who asked who do you call when you call Europe? Who do you call when you call China is actually a very difficult question, because there are about six or seven different governments that could legitimately claim to be the government of China. They can sign treaties. They've done so with the Japanese. They can conduct foreign relations, which they do. American support tends to go to the Nationalist Party under Chiang Kai-shek. But there's also American support during World War II for the communists, and this is going to come back to haunt foreign service officers who said, you know, you might not like communists, but whether you like them or not, they're going to be in charge in the future, and reaching a modus vivendi with them is a good idea. The notion of who we support in the China game is actually one we don't fully think about. There are people writing about it, but when there's a war to win, you work with whomever you can. And both communists and nationalists, not to mention a host of other forces, are the beneficiaries of U.S. technology, U.S. training, and U.S. diplomatic support. The communists, who are going to become the main players in our story, are very good, incidentally, at this point, in seeking support from everybody. They'll seek support from the Soviets, in addition to the Americans. They'll seek support from Tibet. They will even seek support as late as 1941 from Japan, which is a bit that gets written out of Chinese tellings of the story. The Japanese came in, invaded us, and were very evil. The fact that the communists actually considered making peace with Japan in order to preserve their little part of China is something that gets written out of this system. Now, when I'm saying they're making peace with everybody, there's an interesting possibility here, which is, could the Chinese Civil War, which breaks out after World War II between the Chinese nationalists and the communists, have been avoided? You'll hear very often, there is one China, and everybody should recognize there is but one China, if dealing with Chinese diplomats and policymakers. Now, what's interesting is that at the time, post-1945, there was the possibility of two Chinas. Could the nationalists have held on to their bit of territory while the communists held on to theirs? And Mao Zedong, who was later going to become the most fierce proponent of one China, actually thinks this is a possibility. And you can see a situation where, kind of like India and Pakistan, you have two countries that squabble along. Tensions flare up into war, flare down, and life goes on. But that didn't happen. The Civil War did emerge, and the Chinese communists do triumph through careful attention to the balance of power, through guerrilla warfare and then heavy conventional warfare, and of course through running their economy a little bit better than Chiang Kai-shek runs his. The key point about the Civil War that I want us to remember right now is not just that it means a unified China after a very long time, but also that you're seeing the emergence of China as a Pacific power for the first time since 1683, when the Qing Dynasty took Taiwan. They don't manage to conquer Taiwan. They suffer a naval check over there. But they do manage to conquer Hainan Island, learning from mistakes in the Taiwan campaign. And what that means, among other things, is that the capacity to project power to the South China Sea is assured going forward. That's one of the legacies of this time that we're living with. So the communists have won the state. They have put it together. You're talking about a unified China that is free-ish of outside influence for the first time in a long time. And what do they want to do? And this is where the idea of grand strategy comes in. What do I mean by grand strategy? I mean the marshalling of different categories of power, diplomatic, military, economic, to achieve a national objective. So not the way we talk about policy very often in the news. The Russians have done X in Ukraine. What do we do now? Or the Chinese are playing hardball in the trade negotiations. What do we do now? But a more overarching question of what is it that we want in the world? What do we really want? How do the different pieces in the world, everything from China to Russia to India to global warming to you name it, fit to make it difficult for us to get what we want as a whole? And what are the categories of power we're going to use to get there? That's grand strategy. And that's what Chinese leaders at this time instinctively are pretty good at. What's the overarching national objective? It's to keep China secure. All of the people from Mao through to Xi Jinping see China as a brittle entity in a hostile world, and their task, quite simply, is to keep it secure. Okay. Now, basic security sounds like a fairly banal goal, if you think about it. Who doesn't want to be secure? But you should remember two things. First of all, they haven't been secure in a long time. All of the Chinese leaders we're going to talk about have a memory of China as being broken, both during the Opium Wars, then during World War II. And those memories are going to get reinforced over time. There will be memories of the Cultural Revolution, memories of Tiananmen Square. So where we sit up and take, you know, you wake up in the morning, you take the stability of the United States for granted, or at least we used to till fairly recently. A Chinese leader doesn't have that luxury. The notion that the whole thing could fall apart any moment is one that you wake up with every day in Zhongnanhai. The other thing worth remembering is that China is indeed going to have a hard time fending off hostile powers. The geography of the country itself makes that something inevitable in a way. It's very different governing a country with a very long, very vulnerable coast that has been host to invasion and long porous land frontiers than it is governing a country that has, oh, I don't know, three oceans, Canada and Mexico all around it. Just your whole worldview and your national security tasks are going to differ. So how do you achieve that overarching goal of basic security? You seek a balance of power in the Cold War and after. You have to modernize your military. And you have to modernize your economy. And all the while, you have to keep people on your side during this. So that's the basic template of Chinese grand strategy. And that's something that the United States has had a hard time following. One of the interesting things that happens, of course, is that Mao Zedong visits Moscow. And this is the famous lean to one side moment. The interesting thing about leaning to one side, about coming to terms with Joseph Stalin, is that just because you choose to lean to one side doesn't mean you fall over. Even while he's in Moscow, Mao is cabling his subordinates in Beijing, saying, I want you to reach out to the Americans, reach out to the Japanese, reach out to the British for trade relations. Yes, we're communists, but being communist doesn't mean you don't have to do business with everybody else. So we do want to have a balance of power. And it's interesting to speculate how successful he might have been in achieving that if the Korean War hadn't intervened. You want to understand the way Asia looks right now, you have to understand the Korean War. This is the war that literally redraws the map in Asia. Chinese support for the North Koreans at this point, most people don't realize this, isn't a given. There's actually extensive debate in Beijing about what kind of support to extend to the North Koreans. And what wins the day, of course, is the geostrategic rationale. Peng Dehuai, Mao's marshal, says, you can't have a hostile country on the coast and on your northern frontier, hostile force being the United States, and expect to hold on to this country that we've just gobbled together. That's what causes China to send volunteers into the Korean War. It also, of course, means that Taiwan's separation from the mainland becomes crystallized in time. Now, the interesting thing about both the Korean War and the time that follows is that the Chinese never give up on the United States. The idea that if you just reason with the Americans rationally and ask them to come to terms, the Americans, being rational people, will come to terms, is one that they never quite seem to give up on. And there are extensive talks about, can we find a way to get along, which founder, of course, in the question of Taiwan, with the Americans saying, well, Taiwan's an ally, and the Chinese saying, you can't have an ally that's not a sovereign country and is really a part of China. And this is where the American policy of non-recognition of the PRC really takes off. Taiwan is going to be the main sticking point in the relationship for a long, long time to come, and remains so arguably to this day. Now, what changes all of this famously is the Nixon-Kissinger visit to China, the intervention, the idea that we can now use the Chinese in achieving a balance of power that'll be directed against the Soviets. There's a couple of things that get misremembered about this and that got misremembered most recently when people were talking about doing a reverse Nixon, using the Russians against China. And it's worth talking about what gets misunderstood. The first thing that gets misunderstood, of course, is that both Nixon and Kissinger, being fairly sophisticated people, were not intent on using the Chinese against the Soviets. The idea, as Kissinger explained it, was that in a balance of power with three players, you wanted to be closer to all the players than they were to one another. And in other words, the idea is not to stick it to the Russians. The idea is to show them you have options and thereby optimize your relationship with both sides, which the luxury of geography actually allows Washington to do. It's a crucial nuance, but one worth noting. The other thing that gets misremembered is we tend to think of this and portray this as those poor Chinese had their backs against the wall in a war with the Soviets in 68, 69. The Americans swooped in and saved them. That's not quite true. The Chinese weren't stupid, whatever else they were, and there were a lot of other things. They knew that you couldn't necessarily count on professions of goodwill from the United States. As a result of which, even during the clash with the Soviets, they keep on talking to the Soviets. One of the interesting features of Chinese negotiating behavior is just because you don't reach an agreement doesn't mean you drop the dialogue. Simply continuing with talks is an accomplishment. Simply keeping channels of communication open gives you a chance to reach a modus vivendi tomorrow. And they never give up on talking to the Soviets despite the clashes. And even when the rapprochement with the United States has been achieved, giving up on talking to the Soviets is never on the table. In fact, one of the fears in China, and this is one of the things we can talk about this in Q&A that leads to Zhou Enlai's downfall, is the fear that the Americans might try to exploit the Chinese and use them in a war against the Soviets. Don't want to be there. Like Nixon and Kissinger, Beijing wants to be closer to the other two powers than they are to one another. This is also, of course, where the United States' one-China policy begins to really take shape. Take shape is a bit of a misnomer because it's the vaguest, most frustratingly difficult policy to define. You'll often hear the United States recognize then and there was one China. If you actually read the Shanghai Communique, which follows Nixon's visit, closely, what's interesting about it is the distancing in the phrasing. Chinese on both sides of the Taiwan Strait maintain there is but one China. Kind of true. The United States does not dispute this formulation. Okay. Very different from taking a position on what Taiwan is or isn't. Very different from taking a position on what the validity of Beijing's claims is or isn't. Deliberately vague, deliberately ambiguous, in an attempt to reach that modus vivendi that both Beijing and Washington want. And it serves the purpose for the day. It just gives you a problem that other people will have to wrestle with down the line. So that's one piece of how China policy changes during the Nixon-Kissinger years. The other thing that has a dramatic impact on China, and this is one of the reasons they wanted the opening, and one of the reasons that people now regret the opening in certain circles, is trade relations take off. We tend to associate opening and reform, China's economic takeoff, with the Deng Xiaoping years. But if you think of opening and reform as trade relations, investment, economic boom, this actually takes off in the last years of Mao, 71 onwards. Trade with Japan, which always happened, despite Japan being a US ally, skyrockets. Trade with the Americans takes off massively, as does investment. And it's happening during Mao's years. The opening to the United States makes possible the expansion of China's economic miracle. Relations in Deng's time, Deng Xiaoping's time, continue along the same lines. Deng is a very interesting man. His main difference from Mao is travel by boat. As Water Rat says to Mole in The Wind in the Willows, there is nothing, my young friend, absolutely nothing, half so much worth doing as simply messing about in boats. And if you're Deng Xiaoping and you've messed about in a boat, you've seen certain things that a Mao Zedong, who's well-traveled, has actually never seen, because he's only traveled by land. You've seen ports where people bring in goods from distant provinces and distant countries. You've seen ships streaming in. You've seen entrepreneurs haggling in several different languages. And you've seen people grow rich on this. You've seen overseas Chinese in particular grow rich on this. And you're going to look at China's coast, look at ports that people came to trade in once upon a time, and say, we could be doing so much more. You want a theme for Deng Xiaoping's leadership of China. He never actually holds the most formal positions of power, chairman of the party or chairman of the country, because that's for other people. Deng Xiaoping is the puppet master behind the scenes. But if you want a theme for his leadership of the country, it really comes down to whatever works, works. We're going to make things happen. Burning impatience to the man that actually fuels this economic miracle. And that's what he is all about. The main annoyance that comes in the form of U.S.-China relations early on in his leadership is the Taiwan Relations Act, which somewhat ambiguously commits the United States to either defending Taiwan or giving Taiwan the means to defend itself. Depending on whom you ask, it could mean just about anything in the event of Taiwan's security being threatened. And Deng is furious, as are most people in the Chinese leadership, because the understanding there seems to have been that eventually, and if you go over the Kissinger conversations with Chinese leaders, you can see where this understanding came from. The understanding was that eventually, U.S. support for Taiwan would wither away and Taiwan would resume its place as a rightful part of China. Okay. So Deng's response is, how would you feel if we passed a Hawaii Act or an Alaska Act? Which is, you know, a little different, but a little similar, and you can see why they would feel that way. The other thing that happens, of course, is Tiananmen Square. Tiananmen Square flies in the face of the way quite a few American social scientists at the time thought about China. China is liberalizing economically, political liberalization follows economic liberalization. Therefore, eventually, the Chinese, who have now embraced capitalism with full fervor, are going to become democratic, right? That's just the way the world goes. And this is where the misreading of Tiananmen is so intense, because Deng Xiaoping's response to this would probably have been, no, 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 you don't understand at all. In China, to achieve economic liberalization, to achieve opening and reform, I had to argue with people. I had to curb the worst ideological excesses of people in the provinces, of people in the government, and say, we can't live arguing about whether raising three ducks is socialism, but five ducks capitalism. We can't live when you say wages rising is a bad thing. We have to make things work. And to do that, I had to go to political battle with the party. I had to centralize political authority in order for economic liberalism to flourish. And where most observers would see protesting students for democracy as protesting students for democracy, Deng Xiaoping has a very different set of memories. Deng Xiaoping has a set of memories where the protesting students are Red Guards in the Cultural Revolution, who turned his son into a paraplegic. And these people are now threatening to undo everything he has accomplished in his tenure as China's paramount leader. They're unleashing chaos, and they don't understand what they're doing. So the really interesting question about Tiananmen Square, to my mind, is not why did the Chinese pull out the tanks? It's why didn't they break them out earlier? What took them so long? And that's a mystery, I think, that still awaits its solution. U.S. policy here could have been very interesting, and George Bush Sr. and Brent Scowcroft still get faulted for this. But if you think about what our options were, there's a handful. One, you can say we will have nothing else to do with China. It's an evil regime, and we should drop them entirely. Not really something that was plausible, in a way. When a market is that large, when a country is that significant, refusing to talk to it has been tried. You can clap sanctions on it, and there are sanctions that follow Tiananmen Square. Those sanctions are undone because people want to do business with China, including Japan, which says, you know, if you keep these sanctions in place, you're going to embolden the hardliners within the party and undo just about everything you're hoping to accomplish there. Bush and Scowcroft settle on a policy of what you might think of as enlightened realism. We can't do much about China. You can't change China. You can, however, try to keep talking to it. So the famous image of Scowcroft clinking glasses with Chinese leaders right after the students has been massacred is a very disturbing one. It's also worth asking, what else could they have done? What does come from American angst about this, however, is a conviction in China that the United States was, if not directly behind the protests, though you will get that accusation, somehow intent on fomenting chaos within China. And you'll see this in Jiang Zemin's tenure, where the notion of the United States both wants and doesn't want a strong China is one that begins to take hold. Why would the United States want a strong China, Jiang Zemin asks? Well, because of economics. Because they make money off a strong China, and it's too important for business. At the same time, Jiang argues, they fear China's rise and seek to keep us down. That conviction is rooted in his reading of what happens at Tiananmen Square and in quite a bit of what follows. The post-Cold War era is an interesting one in U.S.-China relations. You see the burgeoning of trade between the two countries. You see China's emergence as a WTO member, sponsored by the United States. And you see China, the idea that China could be a responsible stakeholder in the international system. It's Robert Zoellick's phrase, responsible stakeholder. Something that could actually make a difference in world governance in a constructive way. Begin to take hold on both sides. It's also one marked by periodic crises, the 1995-1996 Taiwan Straits crises, and the spy plane incident in Hainan, not to mention the accidental on purpose, depending on whom you talk to, bombing of the Chinese embassy in Yugoslavia. But we can talk about that in Q&A if you want to. And it's worth dwelling a bit on some of these crises and seeing just what happened, because it provides, to my mind, probably the best template for how to manage this relationship going forward. Let's start with Taiwan. In 1995, Jiang seems to have believed that there was an understanding between both the mainland and Taiwan that there was a consensus on one China. Taiwanese will dispute this. That consensus begins to be challenged, if it ever existed, by events on Taiwan, which we can talk about. Most notably, perhaps, the emergence of Li Denghui as Taiwan's leader. Li is an extraordinary man, really fascinating. Compares himself to Moses, famously, leading the Taiwanese to the promised land. If you're comparing yourself to Moses, there is something either right or wrong with you, depending on your point of view. The American stance on China, as we've discussed, Jiang sees an America that wants a strong China and doesn't want it. He's also convinced that we have talked to the Americans about Taiwan. We've told them how we feel about this pain in the neck. And he seems to have believed, with reason, that the United States Secretary of State had promised him that Li Denghui would not get a visa to visit the United States. That's where Jiang is starting from. Visas to the United States, it turns out, are easier to come by every now and then, and when Cornell University invites Li Denghui to give a speech at his alma mater, Li gets his visa and shows up, which is, of course, if you're sitting in Beijing, very bad. So what do you do about this? Well, you cancel senior military visits, you harangue the United States diplomatically, and you do some missile tests to show the Taiwanese you're serious. And the American response at that moment is extraordinarily interesting. In 1995, as the Chinese are lobbing missiles across the Taiwan Strait, we do nothing. Absolutely nothing. And the way that's read in China is, okay, that means that at some level, the United States is okay with this. We should be fine lobbing missiles at Taiwan. So in 1996, when Li Denghui is running for re-election, what do you do? Well, if you're sitting in Beijing, you say, we've played this game before, we lob some missiles at them, and we stage military exercises. And at this point, the United States' response is completely different. We decide we have to do something. There are people arguing for a full-scale war with China. Joseph Prier, who was admiral of, and in charge of Pacific Command at the time, says this isn't the best idea. And the plan is devised to send two aircraft carrier groups, not into the Taiwan Strait, which is how it's often misremembered, because that would have been provocative, but just south of the Taiwan Strait to say they're there. And the crisis is dialed down. It's a crisis that should never have happened, if you think about it. But it's a crisis through in which, by not provoking China too much, but by showing that it was willing to take a stand, the United States was able to achieve an outcome satisfactory to all. And after that, there are talks between the two sides, and the larger stakes of the relationship begin to be evident. Trade, membership in the WTO, so much to get along with. Is Taiwan really worth a full-blown rupture of relations? And it turns out neither side thinks that's the case. Similar dynamic at play in the Hainan spy plane incident, where a Chinese spy plane, a Chinese F-8, rammed an American AP-3. The Chinese pilot died. The American AP-3 lands on Hainan Island. And this is a situation where you first get intense anger on each side, followed by intense calm. So first of all, the Chinese demand an apology. The Americans refuse to apologize because they were in the right. And then they start talking, and the Americans say, well, we can say we're sorry for the death of the pilot and for the failure of authorities on Hainan to hear the plane's distress signal. And that's not an apology, but it's saying we're sorry. And the Chinese sit down and say, well, we can construe this as an apology if we try hard enough. And the crew's released. You can see how this could have gone wrong at several different points, but calmer heads prevailed, and everything was dialed down. So that's the template of the relationship in the 90s. You get to today, and you have Xi Jinping in charge, along with Donald Trump, and things begin to look a little stickier. We can talk about Trump in Q&A if you want, but very quickly, I want to talk about Xi Jinping. Bill mentioned that I'd focused on the growth of Chinese insecurity, and I think that insecurity is personified most dramatically in Xi Jinping. It's worth remembering that Xi was a princeling, that his experience of life was the Cultural Revolution, where his dad was taken away, and he himself was sent to do hard labor. That experience, the notion that everything can be taken away from you, is something that informs everything he does. Now, different people respond differently to different life events. If you're Jiang Zemin responding to a memory of the Cultural Revolution, you say, moral of the story, don't rock the boat, don't let the perfect become the enemy of the good. If you're Xi Jinping, however, you say, moral of the story, everything can be taken away from you, so centralize power right now and make sure that nobody can ever do something like that to you again. And if you think about the Chinese conduct in Xinjiang, if you think about Chinese conduct in Hong Kong right now, if you think about it in the South China Sea, it's driven by the sense of if we don't do something to secure everything absolutely 100% right now, everything could fall apart. It's a sincerely held but deeply misguided belief. A couple of other things about Xi that are worth noting before we get to Q&A. First of all, that willingness to keep talking no matter what seems to be at play. Most notably in relations with Japan, where you go from almost crisis in the East China Sea to the frostiest handshake in history between Xi Jinping and Shinzo Abe, to a point now where the Japanese relationship with China actually seems in some respects better than the Japanese relationship with the United States, which is something you wouldn't have thought you would have ever said in the post-war era. Relations with Russia continue to grow, but with Russia, incidentally, people talk about how there can't be much trust. I think both Moscow and Beijing, if you committed them to telling the truth, would say the point isn't to trust. The point is to just keep having a relationship despite the lack of trust and see where it goes. And finally, One Belt, One Road is worth thinking about. The panic about One Belt and One Road in Washington strikes me as intense. But One Belt and One Road is also, if you think about it, just the natural culmination of a country that has grown to the size and heft of China, exercising an economic influence in the world. If you compare it with what people in the past have done in terms of investment and trade, it's really not that unusual. So where do we go from here? I think the first thing that's going to happen in U.S.-China relations is, in an election year, things are tough to talk about. Nobody wants to talk about a reasonable policy on China in this country, and people don't usually vote based on foreign policy either. Being tough on China has traditionally been a good way of winning elections. The Chinese have a hard time understanding why that is, and we can talk more about that if you want to. I think the other thing that's worth saying is that the model of success we've talked about in both U.S. and China relations, growing rich, in other words, through business and trade, is one that's beginning to be undermined. And it's beginning to be undermined by climate change. Our whole way of life, if you think about it, is based on the idea that economic growth is a good thing. Sustainable growth is something that's only just beginning to be talked about. If you think about the way China's success has been based on building massive dams or investing massive amounts of money in foreign countries, and if you then think about the disruptions to water supplies, to fishing populations, to forestry, the things that make it possible for us as human beings to live, you begin to see why this whole model of modernity that was embraced over here and then in China is one that could end in the extinction of human beings as a species. If that problem, if the problem of nuclear Armageddon, if the problem of world poverty, if all those problems are to be solved in some meaningful way, it will probably require a much more sensible approach to U.S.-China relations than this country has shown, and that with the insecurity in China itself, might be difficult to pursue right now. And I'd say one task going ahead is to see how can we get from where we are right now to a way in which these two countries can talk about how to solve the most pressing problems facing humanity. Thank you.